Hello, and welcome to Distillations, weekly extracts from the past, present, and future of chemistry. I'm Robert Hicks. Each week, we bring you stories on all things chemical, from boron to ballistics. In this week's show, we'll look at the technology of warfare and how military weapons become civilian tools over time. We'll learn about an element that influenced body armor during World War I and review a new book on the Civil War. That's all coming up on today's episode of Distillations. To say that warfare is brutal is clearly an understatement. Science and technology have always been key elements of war, from the use of rotting bodies as biological weapons in sieges during the Middle Ages to the development of guided missile systems in the second half of the 20th century. Tools developed for warfare often find a second life in the civilian world. We've all heard that the internet was originally developed as a military tool, and the radar technology now associated with commercial airlines and shipping was first developed during the Second World War. Last week, a group of scholars met at the Chemical Heritage Foundation to discuss the history and implications of these so-called dual-use technologies. Villanova history professor Jeffrey Johnson was one of the organizers of this conference. I spoke with him about the role of chemical technology in military history. Professor Johnson, thank you for joining us today on Distillations.
Thank you, Robert.
Well, let's begin with the first question. Explain what are dual-use technologies.
A dual-use technology could be defined perhaps as something that you might say is related to the old dilemma of guns or butter in warfare. The difference is that with dual-use, the same product or the same process produces both the guns and the butter. In this case, we're probably thinking about chemicals that could be used for a variety of purposes, for example, fertilizer or explosives, or perhaps poison gas.
Let's talk about the role of German scientists in World War I. Give us some background. What were the German scientists up to?
It's probably better to begin with the problem that the Germans had at the outbreak of the war in August 1914, which was that they realized very early on that they were using their explosives at a much higher rate than they had expected, because artillery proved to be much more important in the war than anybody had figured. And the idea of using some alternative method to dislodge troops from the trenches began to present itself early on. In January or so of 1915, a German scientist named Fritz Haber had the brilliant idea of using chlorine gas. And the German high command then said, well, this sounds like a great idea. So they began to pursue that.
Your example of Fritz Haber is very interesting. Given the tide of nationalism or patriotic fervor in Germany, how did most chemists respond to the challenge of working in government, mindful that their application would go to the battlefield and would kill or maim many people?
I think that's an excellent question, because there were, in fact, a number of people who did have moral qualms about this. Emil Fischer, in fact, by the end of the war, he had lost two sons out of his three and was beginning to have serious doubts about what he had done. To the degree that he felt the high command had not made proper use of German science, and the leadership from the Kaiser on down had essentially wasted all their opportunities, and so millions of people had died for nothing. So he reflected on the problem that he, in fact, through his work in organic chemistry, had contributed to the deaths of many of those millions. Another example is an industrial scientist and leader of what came to be called IG Farben, the main German dye trust, Carl Duisberg. And Duisberg, in the early stage of the war, was one of the people in the fall of 1914 who was testing various types of chemical agents for use in the war. At the time, he confided to a friend of his that he felt that what this work was barbaric. And he felt that the only reason you could justify it was because the fatherland was in danger. And so for that reason, he was willing to fight. So different people had different reactions. Some who were more cautious at the beginning later became less so. Some who were less cautious became more so.
So in a very short period of time, all these developments, this technology advances to this degree. What characterizes this research during that period leading up to World War II?
The German chemists, after the war, continued to do research on a low level on various types of chemical agents. They had to be very careful about this because, essentially, the Versailles Treaty, which ended the war, outlawed the use of poison gas and chemical agents. In addition, going back to this concept of dual use, you could develop pesticides, which was, of course, permissible, but some of those pesticides could also be useful for other purposes. And, of course, the classic ones are the nerve gases, which were developed in the 1930s. And they discovered that, in fact, these things didn't just kill bugs, but they could also kill people.
One final question, Professor Johnson. We think of World War I, World War II as total wars. How does that then jibe with dual-use technologies? Or another way of asking the question, do we have dual-use technologies when war is being conducted that absorbs all resources?
I would say that, in fact, dual-use technologies become most crucial in a situation in which total war or something close to total war begins to develop. In the German case, I could look at the development of something that was called the Hindenburg Program in the fall of 1916. The plan essentially deliberately included a design of factories that we could call dual-use factories. You would build the factory, but you agreed that you would keep that factory in readiness for a period of 10 to 15 years following the conclusion of hostilities, meaning that if war was declared again, you could put that factory back into operation within a matter of weeks, producing poison gas or explosives or whatever you wanted to produce. However, when war wasn't going on, these factories were designed to produce peacetime products, so that dual use was inherent in the design from the very beginning.
This is fascinating. Thank you very much for joining us today on Distillations.
You're very welcome. I've enjoyed speaking with you.
Jeffrey Johnson is a professor of history at Villanova University and the author of a number of books on science and war, including Frontline and Factory, co-edited with Roy McLeod. For more information and links to past shows, please visit our website at distillations.chemheritage.org. You're listening to Distillations. I'm Robert Hicks. Soldiers of war have used all manner of personal armor, including leather, copper, steel, and silk. But with every change of armor comes a change of weaponry. In today's Element of the Week, Jennifer Dionisio explains how this cycle played out in the First World War.
Chlorine was first discovered in the late 18th century by Swedish chemist Carl Wilhelm Scheele. It's an element we now associate with the sharp scent of swimming pools and bleaching agents. It's found naturally in salt, and our bodies use it to help break down food. But chlorine also played a major role in the development of military weapons and armor. In the early 20th century, most soldiers went into battle with little more protection than a flak helmet. Even when body armor was used during World War I, changes in weaponry often made the protective gear useless. Cutting-edge bulletproof vests made of layered silk were no match for high-velocity bullets raining down from machine guns. To protect themselves, soldiers turned to the earth itself, digging into trenches fortified with rock and wood. But as soldiers dug in, new weapons, like chlorine gas, were used to infiltrate even the most well-protected hiding spots. When soldiers donned gas masks to protect themselves from chlorine, weapons makers began using other gaseous agents, like mustard gas, to attack the skin as well as the respiratory tract. Every time a new defense was developed, a new weapon was created to overcome it. Chlorine is now primarily used for civilian purposes, but its historical legacy is crucial to understanding the role of dual-use technologies. And that's it for the Element of the Week. I'm Jennifer Dionisio.
Jennifer Dionisio is Program Coordinator for Biotechnology at the Chemical Heritage Foundation's Center for Contemporary History and Policy. Finally today, a look at the American Civil War, one of the bloodiest episodes in American history, leaving at least 600,000 soldiers and an unknown number of civilians dead. Harvard University President Drew Gilpin Faust takes stock of this legacy of death in her new book, This Republic of Suffering, Death and the American Civil War, recently published by Knopf. CHF's Audra Wolf has this review.
Drew Gilpin Faust's new book has a counterintuitive premise. For all the thousands of books scholars have produced on the American Civil War, we still don't have an understanding of what all that death meant. In a little under 300 pages of crisply written prose, Faust shows us how soldiers and their families came to terms with war's violent legacy. and how the federal government gradually came to see caring for its wartime dead as a national responsibility. I picked up this book hoping to learn more about what they did with all of those bodies. The history of mortuary science is a decidedly chemical topic, but it's one that, perhaps understandably, hasn't attracted much attention. Although Faust devotes less than a chapter to this issue, what she tells us about it is fascinating. It was the fervent desire of most soldiers to be buried in their native soil. While this wasn't possible for most enlisted men, who were usually buried near the battlefields, hospitals, or prisons where they died, a surprising number of Northern officers, and even some Southern officers, were in fact transported home. Some were simply covered in charcoal and shipped in airtight metallic coffins, but others were embalmed. Prior to this point, embalming had mainly been used to preserve cadavers for medical education, but during the Civil War, the practice became more common. Undertakers set up shop near battlefields and advertised their services in Northern newspapers, offering to disinter, disinfect, and ship bodies across the country, for a price, of course. High-profile bodies, like those of Stonewall Jackson and Abraham Lincoln, were embalmed to allow a period of public display and mourning that offered a substitute for the hundreds of thousands of private funerals that could not be held. Soon embalming, with its promise of a restful sleep, seemed the most natural way to deal with death. Perhaps when Faust finishes her tenure at Harvard, she can produce a book that tackles the technical history of death as satisfyingly as this one deals with death's cultural history. I'm Audra Wolf.
And that's it for today's episode of Distillations. Today's quotation is from a speech by William Jennings Bryan at the 1896 Democratic Convention. "The humblest citizen of all the land, when clad in the armor of a righteous cause, is stronger than all the hosts of error." Distillations is a presentation of the Chemical Heritage Foundation and is made possible by the generous support of the Richard Lounsbery Foundation. Mia Lobel is our senior producer. Our assistant producer is Victoria Indeviro, and our executive producer is Audra Wolf. Our theme music is composed and performed by Dave Kaufman. Additional music provided from the PodSafe Music Network. Check it out at music.podshow.com. Please tell us what you think about our program and send suggestions for future shows to distillations@chemheritage.org. Until next time, I'm Robert Hicks.